Welcome to the Mortal Realms. Grab your hammer so we can clear a path through the chaos and forge our own narratives in the Age of Sigmar. Your allies through the Realm Gate this episode are Eric of Shyish.
Just back from the Blood Reaver Supper Club, it's Davey.
And coming to you this episode from Shamon, the Realm of Metal, it's Mal.
The Mortal Realms is a podcast focused on the Age of Sigmar, a new fantasy battle game by Games Workshop. Our podcast is about maximizing the fun that we and anyone listening can have playing Age of Sigmar. We'll be discussing stories and fluff, hobby, gameplay and tactics, news in the community, as well as being a resource for new players. If you have a gaming event coming up, let us know. We want to be a support for anyone else who contributes to the AOS community. Welcome to the Mortal Realms podcast. Thanks for listening. This episode is meant to be a primer on the Age of Sigmar game, something you can share with friends that you're hoping to see across the table from your rolling dice. That means we are going to talk a little bit about the new game, the newness of it, the direction of it that's different from a lot of other things. We're going to talk about the story, some of the introductory story thus far. Davey, Mal, and I have been eating up every novel that's been coming out and want to share some of that with you in future episodes. We're also going to talk a little bit about, getting people into the hobby that may have never done hobby before and just more of what our philosophy is in this game. And we're going to talk a little bit about, what the game is like when the plastic hits the table. We're going to forego introductions of Davey, Mal, and I this episode. Next episode, we hope to do that so you can get to know more about us. But here we thought it was more important for you, listener, who's getting into Age of Sigmar, to have a quick primer, something you can get right into, not have a lengthy conversation on us. But what's most important is getting into the game and the endless fun that we think we can have here. So without further ado, let's start our first topic. The community phase. In the community phase, we talk about news and events that are significant to the game. So in July 2015, GW launched Age of Sigmar. What do you guys think is so different about Age of Sigmar? How does it stand out in the market that we're in?
Okay, so I guess from my perspective, it's not a game of measuring and angles and precision. It's not like a math class, which is often what I felt that previous editions of Warhammer could fall into. It's very free-flowing. It maintains that kind of fantasy vibe, but in a light, fast, fun-to-play, skirmish-type deal, which is it's not something that we've that I've seen really since the days of more time. I don't know how do you guys feel about that?
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. You're not doing a crazy amount of math here. Everything's kind of laid out for you. What I like is kind of the ease of play. You've got whatever models you've got, you can play with them, and you lay out your four pages of rules, and you lay out your war scrolls, and you got everything you need right there. And there's not a lot of diving into the books, and there's not a lot of that, which isn't to say that there's not depth there, but it's all presented right in front for you. I think that's been kind of an exciting thing that we've seen in the initial games that we've played thus far.
Yeah, I echo what you were saying, Mal. One of the things I said early on that I felt is that even just watching games before I even got my first game, is it felt like it was more cinema than algebra. that it was something of it had an art to it. And I think that with that 4-page rule set, there's a quote that sometimes given to Einstein, and the idea is that any intelligent fool can make something more complex, but it takes a touch of genius to go the other direction. And I'm not saying necessarily that GW is genius, but it's hard as hell to make something less and still work. And obviously, we'll explore more about that. But then the idea that such a huge company put out rules for free, 4 pages of rules, 400 plus war scrolls, plus the battle plans, they really want people to play with it. They've gone a long way to do that.
Yeah, I think it's talking about it from a kind of, I mean, I may be wrong here, but from a like a business and a kind of future proofing their income streams, this making the rules free is kind of and especially when you combine that with the app, you know, the Age of Sigmar app, where you can get all the rules and all the war scrolls on top of you there in your mobile device, good to go, in a legitimate way, rather than having to kind of torrent them, download them, pirate them. I think there's a realization there that the books and the rules are not, although they're going to remain important to the company, that's not where this business is going to make its money in the future, especially, you know, in the digital media age, because it becomes, you know, you already get, there's enough whining and upset about how much, and I think justified actually, but how much the digital copies of various codexes, army books, etc., cost vis-a-vis the print copies, you know, almost exactly the same price, which you know, GW are really the only company that have that pricing model, and I think they've realized it's pretty untenable. So to give the rules away for free is kind of implicitly saying, yep, you know, actually, we are going to have to make our money from the models and nothing else. And the rules, whilst an important part of the game, because clearly they put a lot of thought into it, they're not going to be, you know, we can't expect to be milking that particular cash cow going forward. That's my reading of it. It may turn out to be completely wrong, but from where I'm standing just now, that seems kind of reasonable.
I think you're onto something with the different focus. Especially interesting to me, and obviously this is a very controversial part, or certainly something new that they're doing, where there's, without the points values, it's really kind of put the emphasis on kind of deciding for yourselves how you're going to play that out. Just the whole army building has been much more open as far as like thinking about, you know, instead of, is this excellent value for its points, I'm thinking, does this make sense as part of this army? And that's made for some interesting, just a different way of thinking about, you know, what army you're going to build, or what army you're going to put together, what you have. And it really changes how you're thinking about the models that you're putting on the table, as opposed to, no, this is overcosted garbage, I'm never going to put this out. So, I think that may tie in with the idea of, you know, their focus is on the models, because that's how the game is focused so much, rather than on the books themselves.
I think one of the other really interesting things is the fact that whatever setting you want to fight a battle in, there's a home for it in the Mortal Realms, because you've got, you know, all the different, the Realm of Life, the Realm of Metal, you know, almost anything that you can think of in terms of terrain to play over or a scenario to play in, then you can recreate that in this game, which is very exciting. And we're not limited to the to any kind of one setting, like kind of medieval Renaissance type history that we may have done before. I mean, how do you guys feel about that?
Yeah, you're hitting on something pretty interesting here, where your imagination is wide open, because instead of where can you go in, you know, this one particular world, you have where can you go in eight realms. So you have eight realms of which to, you know, think of, okay, what does this army look like? You know, what does a chaos army look like when it's running around in the realm of fire, versus what does it look like in the realm of beasts, and similar for all of them. And on top of that, the battlefields. And that's why there's a lot of potential inspiration with terrain that you might do. And even that, whatever terrain you make, you can actually use. You can run over the top of it. You can go through it in that cinematic way that Eric was talking about before.
So what's your Davey? What's your take on that? I mean, if you know, we've seen already in the Realm of Fire, you know, very cornate kind of warriors running around the Igneous Delta, the kind of plains, and I guess we're starting to see the realms of life, you know, because the story we're being presented is that it's going to be all very, very kind of Nurgle centric. You know, how do you, what do you, you know, so if you're taking, for example, some of the other realms, what do you, you know, for, let's talk about Hish, you know, the Realm of Light. What do you think, what does a Chaos army look like there?
It'd be very interesting. And the particular one you picked is, I feel like we have maybe less information than any other one with that. They just kind of talk about puzzles and symbols and all that. So that one feels almost the most wide open. I'm actually real excited to learn more about that. To circle back, even though, like, what we've seen of the realms that we have seen, life, metal, fire, we've only seen small pieces of those. Like, we know what's going on in the Igneous Delta, but that realm is enormous. You know, there might be deserts somewhere else. There's all kinds of possibilities. So, even within the one, that's what I like, you know. So if you have an idea for a desert goblin tribe or something, you know, what realm might they, could they be that could, might fit into the Realm of Light and might fit into the Realm of Beast, might fit into another part of the Realm of Fire. And it's the wide open part of the background and the modeling possibilities. That's something that's really appealing to me. Right.
What's really cool about this openness is that you can use every piece of terrain that you already have. If you've got it from, you know, almost from another game system, it will fit here. You can just make it work. At the same time, the new stuff that's coming out, the setting that they've created for Age of Sigmar feels completely unique to itself. The Ophidian Archway, the stylings of the Realm Gates, they feel completely unique, and that they fit here in this high fantasy, kind of over the top kind of way, but it all works together, which I think. To be able to create a space where anything goes and create something so signature that you're going to instantly be able to recognize something that's Age of Sigmar over something else. But I also had a question for you guys on the idea of, I mean, this is a game, the rule set, because it doesn't have the ability to, you know, tell everybody how to set up an army, right? If you come with 1,500 points or 200 points or whatever the scale is, right, what that's typically been good for is showing up for pickup games. Do you think that Games Workshop has moved their focus from kind of the pickup game to back to the garage, kind of gaining more kind of traction with friends or people you already know?
So I think it's the question, the pickup. Yeah, is it more about where you're playing or the type of game you're playing, which I guess is the same question really. I think, I mean, my impression is that why would the company really care about how or why we were playing this game? I think that one of the it's very difficult to answer that with any sort of degree of certainty, because ultimately, maybe, you know, does Games Workshop really care how we play this game? And I think this is probably what we're seeing now is the firmest indication yet that no, they really don't. They want us to play it however we want to play it, but they're giving us a really, really strong tool set perhaps to play it in one particular direction, which is, like you say, the kind of the narrative fun talk about before, social contract, game part of war game rather than the war part of war game. Make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And Eric's talking about, you know, the difference between a pickup game and you know, a garage game or a basement game or something like that. But with the right group, you might have an entire club that is essentially the same as playing, you know, playing at home, playing around the table in the basement or the garage or wherever. You know, that you have that, could have that same feel in your club. And if you can cultivate that, then the idea of showing up with, hey, I was thinking I had this cool idea, a little bit of coordination beforehand, you know, say, hey, anybody interested in doing, you know, something looking like a siege, or I'd like to try this scenario out. Has anyone got some ideas? So, yeah, it might be difficult to come in with a complete and total stranger and be on the same page. But that was always true in the past. You know, you might not click with that total stranger. So what I like is you mentioned that social contract and where it kind of is elevated a little bit, and we're looking at, all right, let's agree, let's make sure we're coming at this game from the same direction. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity for some pretty fun games that way.
Yeah, I think more than ever, we are less likely to see, okay, here's a flat 6x4 table, and you line all your guys up, and I'll line all my guys up, and then we'll go at it hammer and tongs. You know, that's I think if you try and, my personal opinion is, if you try and play Age of Sigmar in that manner, it will work, but you're not going to see it at its best, and you're probably not going to have as much fun as you could have if you invested that extra 5-10% of your time thinking about, right, what am I trying to recreate, or what is the experience that I'm trying to bring to life with my miniatures and with my friend that I'm playing with, as opposed to, you know, how can I leverage angles and probability, et cetera. So they're if they're going for anything, they're going for enjoyment.
And I guess I would argue that I do think that the way they've developed it and what they're pushing, the way they see growth in this game happening, is not by just being able to find strangers who just happen to like this game also, right? Which is, I feel like, what they've had to rely on in the past. But with Age of Sigmar, they've created a rule set that you can share with your friends that maybe haven't had as many experiences with wargaming or tabletop gaming, or with your spouse who's not as interested in a long 4-hour game. I think that they see the path forward of this growth, and even in like what you both are saying, with that the strength here is narrative, fun, and a conversation beforehand, which is easier when you're talking with the friends, when you're building clubs that of that. And I would say one of the most significant things Games Workshop has done, and I'm on the verge of, you know, trying not to call him a genius every time I talk, but the fact that every wargamer is talking about, you know, how do we make this game fair? How do we rock up to a table and make sure that, you know, the other person's having fun? That's hard. But that's where when both players are trying to help the other person have fun, that's when the best games happen. And I think you're going to get that most through, you know, people who are there to have fun and, you know, care about your fun as well.
Yeah, I guess kind of, yes, yeah, it's a really interesting point, actually. They probably realized that, you know, the potential that there has been in the past to say, well, you know, it doesn't make, you know, this unit is not worth its points vis-a-vis this unit, etc. Well, actually, you know, that's a big problem. How do we, you know, and people have traditionally called back, I'm not talking about just Games Workshop here, but people have traditionally called back to the games companies and said, oh, you know, you've got to balance this, you've got to make this right for us. Well, actually, Games Workshop have turned it all on its head and said, look, you know, this is your game, guys. You know, you're the ones that are going to be playing it. We're going to facilitate you with some models, but actually, if you want to make it enjoyable and balanced and fun for you at the time you're playing with your friends in your environment, then you've got to shoulder some of the put some of the effort in and make that your problem. And I think that's a completely legitimate way of doing it, because if you kind of if we as war gamers traditionally pretty lazy, and if we, you know, if we're allowed to abrogate too much responsibility and say, no, company X, you know, churn out this rule set and I want to play this like a board game, then I think we have as a kind of global community perhaps been too guilty of that in the past. And the way that Age of Sigmar is set up is to turn that completely on its head and not allow us to do that, force us to have a conversation and actually force us to enjoy ourselves and make a better experience for the people we're playing with, which is awesome.
It is interesting, because it's got me thinking of, you know, scenarios. How can I string some scenarios together? And I'm thinking about this much more in line with the way I thought about these games when I first got into them, was really excited about them, you know, as a young man, and, you know, trying to set up that really cool story with friends. And so I think we have the tools to do that, and a game with the attitude to do that. So that's what's pretty exciting to me about it.
And I think what you said, Mal, is that a lot of times we rely very heavily on the game systems to tell us how to have fun with the games that out of the box, or, you know, pitch battle, make pitch battle fun. And what we want to do here in this podcast, in the Mortal Realms, is pick apart, find ways, look in the corners and the cracks, lift up the rocks, find the tactics, the strategies, the synergies, the terrain pieces, the stories that we think will help make Age of Sigmar fun and easier to get into. So we want to do some of that heavy lifting amongst us, so that you know, those listening can kind of benefit and have the best experience with Age of Sigmar that they can. All agreed?
Very much so.
The story phase.
In the story phase, we delve into the stories and characters that inhabit the mortal realms. So what are the first things we learn about the story of Age of Sigmar? One thing we know is that there were two ages before the Age of Sigmar, the Age of Myth and the Age of Chaos. Davius is going to tell us a little bit about the Age of Chaos, and Mal is going to introduce us to the Age of Sigmar. I'm going to get us started with the Age of Myth. After the destruction of the Old World, the core of the planet was hurtling through the void as a twin-tailed comet for what could have been eons. Clinging to the flaming core was the god King Sigmar. A celestial dragon notices the comet and then Sigmar. The dragon revives him and reveals the eight mortal realms, which are connected by realm gates. As Sigmar explores the mortal realms, he discovers, awakens, and frees other gods in each realm. Tyrion, the god of light in Hyish. Malarion, the god of shadow in Ulgu. Grugni and Grimnir, the gods of fire in Akshi. Gorkamorka, the god of beasts in Gur. Nagash, the god of death in Shaiish, and Elariel, the goddess of life in Giron. Sigmar formed an alliance between all the gods of magic and created a utopia that lasted for a time. The mortal realms remained hidden from the chaos gods. But as gods sought their own goals, the alliance began to crumble. In particular, two of the gods sought out the chaos god Slaanesh and imprisoned him. This turned the heads of the other chaos gods.
The Age of Chaos. As the Age of Myth drew to a close, Sigmar's alliance began to destabilize. The true impact of this was at first masked as the chaos gods tore at each other, each trying to claim the domains of Slaanesh for themselves. It was not until the Dark Brothers realized a greater prize, the Mortal Realms, was there for the taking, that truly things took a turn for the worse. With the cracks forming in his pantheon, Sigmar's defenses were strained from the outset. Denizens of the realms called it the Red Century, but worse was to come. As in ages past and to come, the gods found a champion to unify their efforts. Archaon, ender of the world that came before, was to lead a new assault, exploiting the new weaknesses. Archaon oversaw a coordinated masterstroke to take the All Points, a crucial nexus providing access to all the realms. Desperate battle ensued as Sigmar and his remaining allies rushed to hold the line. The outcome was still in question until the Dark Gods gained a foothold from Shaiish. As the All Points flooded with the followers of Chaos, Sigmar knew he had been betrayed and the pantheon of the Age of Myth was now truly in tatters. Sigmar sought out vengeance against Nagash, but could not bring the great necromancer to account for his betrayal. Losses mounted, defeat begat defeat, and eventually even Gal-Mirazz was lost to the God King. Seeking some way to salvage anything from the catastrophe, Sigmar retreated to the realm of Azir. For the denizens of the realm of the heavens, it meant salvation. The other seven realms, however, were left to a much darker fate. As the Age of Sigmar approaches, only the last scraps of humanity cling to life in a sea of madness. Untold years have passed, and in the mortal realms, chaos victory is almost complete.
Okay, and so now we come to the Age of the Sigmar, the here and now for this game, the kind of setting of where it is and what we're playing in. Just to recap, we've had the Age of Myth, which represents almost the high-level theology for this new game. We've got the deep, deep backstory, you've got the Sigmar, the Dracothia, and all that good stuff. And then we're followed on with the Age of Chaos, where all goes wrong, where Nagash betrays everyone, acts like a gigantic douche, which should be no surprise to anyone familiar with his character. And Sigmar is all like, screw you guys, I am going home. I'm going to lock these realm gates and I'm going back to Azir and sort this stuff out. So that's what he does. He seals the realm gates using his super powerful magic and he heads back to Azir and he gets together with Grungi, the dwarf god, so who was the kind of one of the elementals of metal from the previous game. And he's all like, well, I lost Galmaraz, my magic hammer. So what are we going to do? How are we going to sort the mortal realms out now that I've locked them all away? I've got to do something with them. So he talks to Grungi, and Grungi's all like, well, we've got the core of the world that was. It's made of Sigmarite. Let's start using that Sigmarite to do something positive. And Grungi goes to work. So he's in this huge volcano, which is his forge, and he's hammering on the Sigmarite, and he's coming up with new weapons, new ways for Sigmar to have an effect on the mortal realms when the time comes. At the same time, Sigmar is kind of using his magic to pick and choose amongst the mightiest warriors across the mortal realms. So every time, you know, a warrior is just on his last legs, you know, he's about to die. He's facing unsurmountable odds or insurmountable odds. He's so heroic. Those guys are the guys that Sigmar wants in his new army. So he pulls him away from the mortal realms, brings him up to Azirheim, which is this new city he's built, and he puts him through a war called the Trials of Becoming, which is a process of becoming a Stormcast Eternal, which is this new type of warrior, clad in Sigmarite armor, wielding Sigmarite weapons, and cast down to earth on these bolts of thunder and lightning that Grungi has provided for Sigmar to enable him to retake the mortal realms. And that's what he does. He looks at the planet, or looks in the mortal realms, and he decides where his beachhead is going to be, and he decides on the Igneous Delta. There's a realm gate on the Igneous Delta that he wants to open up. That's his first port of contact. So he sends down Vandas Hammerhand and the Hammers of Sigmar, so that the Primo Legion, or the Primo Chamber of the Stormcast Eternals, and they head down there, and they're trying to open up the realm gate. And it's at this point that they get into a huge fight with the Gortide, who are the Khorne warriors, led by Korgos Kull. And really, that's at that point there is where we pick up the story with the Age of Sigmar box set, and where the story really begins for this new game. And if you're half as excited about it as me, then you're bouncing off the walls, because I think this is going to be a great time.
The Hero Phase.
In the hero phase, we turn our attention to the listeners that want to get started in the Age of Sigmar, or how we can share the game with our friends.
So I asked this question. If somebody's just heard about Age of Sigmar, or you know, wants to learn more about it, what's the best place to start?
Great question. Well, I think the obvious answer is on the GW website. Grab yourself a copy of the rules. They're there for free. Or grab yourself a copy of the app for your mobile device. If you have a Android or iOS, check the rules out, read them through, try and get your head around them, try and visualize in your mind how that's going to work. Then scroll, look at all the I guess the website is an awesome place to go, because you know it's set out like a shop window. But actually, you know, if you've made the decision after you've read your four pages of rules that you want to jump in and play, then ultimately you're going to need some models. And I think there's no better way without getting super involved in the. In the fluff and the background and the lore, what Workshop has done now, which is I think awesome, is they've given you the ability to read through the war scrolls and kind of conceptualize how those. I appreciate this is difficult for the beginning player who may not have played a war game before, but you can get a pretty decent idea of how units are going to interact and how they're going to behave on the tabletop. You know, for example, if in your head a war game is a bunch of guys with bows and arrows firing projectiles across the field and taking people out before you get anywhere near them. Then clearly, if you choose if you look at the war scrolls and you see a set of models that don't have any kind of ranged fire, maybe they're not the guys for you. So I think that they've made it very, very easy now to get a feel for how a unit, how a faction might play, and how that may then shape your considerations about what you want to, which models you want to pick up. I mean, Davey, do you want to talk about just the kind of straight up the aesthetics of the models?
Yeah, well, I'd just touch on a thing there. Mal's talking from almost a perspective of if you know something about wargaming, maybe you want to be looking at those war scrolls, but let's say you don't know anything about it. Look at something that you figure out what models you enjoy the look of, and you can pick up what you need. I mean, if you're bringing someone to the game who doesn't know anything about wargaming, rules aren't going to mean a lot to them. How that model looks is going to mean a whole lot to them. They pick a line, whatever it be, wood elves or chaos or anything like that. If it's something that appeals to them, that's going to get them excited to get those on the table. And then you can figure out how to make them work. I mean, that's kind of how this game is structured. Having said that, if anything in the starter set is appealing, that's crazy value for what you're getting. Like if you like the Bloodbound side, if you like the Stormcast side, that's great. And it's also a good place to learn the rules. Eric and I played through the initial scenarios, and it starts with some of the cool looking, like the very first scenario is like you get the Khorgorath versus Vandis Hammerhand, you know, two extremely cool looking models, real basic. You can figure out the rules, but you get to use the neat looking stuff right off the bat. So from my perspective, I'd find, get that person hooked on, you know, interested. What models do you like the look of? All right, we can make that work. Let's make it happen.
The place I started when I was, when the Age of Sigmar first came out, and I was just, I hadn't had a chance. I was busy with work. I couldn't quite get, you know, my hands on the models, get them assembled fast enough. Is I went to a couple of spots on YouTube to watch them playing some of these starter games, and kind of seeing the joy of other people watching them first and working through how the game played. One of the places I went that I had a lot of fun was Guerrilla Miniatures? Oh, Guerrilla Wargaming. And then another one was Mini Wargaming, which is out of Canada. I think both of those might be out of Canada. Those Canadians know how to make a YouTube channel. And the way they go through them and, you know, kind of have a critical eye, walk you through the steps, are trying to understand it themselves as they're going through it, so you don't feel like you're terribly lost, you know, because they haven't played it either, right? And I definitely, I picked up the starter set because it was an easy first glimpse into kind of the flagship of this new game. Now, that being said, Games Workshop is trying to set out kind of these, you know, they're highlighting some new groups, some new war scrolls, kind of formations type of thing. I think that's a really good place to start. It doesn't always give you everything, you know, in the range, but it certainly can give you kind of give you some direction and just say, hey, get these three models or these 20 models, or they may have a box set already for you to kind of pick out. And there's some really good deals out there. The Sylvaneth box, I think, you know, you're basically, it's three treemen, which are some of the coolest new models, you know, in the range. And then the Dryads, which are older models, but still really cool looking. And, you know, basically the 32 or 36 Dryads are almost free for that price. So you're just getting a real good deal. You're getting a ton of models on the table. You know, you get to use some of the benefits of a war scroll made just for that formation, which is, I think, can be cool for anybody just getting started. Mal, what was the first, I guess, what faction are you thinking about getting into, or have you started getting into?
Yeah, I picked up the starter set, and I've assembled all of the Stormcast Eternals. And I picked up a couple of supplementary boxes as well to sort of flesh that out a little bit. So, yeah, right now I have three units of the Liberators. So that's two with the hammers and the shields, all completely finished, and one set that I got as a sort of add-on box set with the dual swords, and then I have the Retributors all done. and then I have the rest of the stuff is all base painted, all over painted gold, and you're ready to start getting blocked up.
What made you go all in on the Stormcaster tournament?
What made me go in? I think because they're different. Because there's nothing like them in the Age of Sigmar mythos, or in this kind of in the continuity. Because I think we have to recognize that it's an all new game, but it comes from a background perspective. It comes from a tradition, and there's nothing like the Stormcast Eternals in that tradition, which is why they appeal to me. They're so different. They're new, they're shiny, literally they're very shiny. So I figured that's why I wanted to give them a whirl.
How about you, Davey? What set are you thinking of building?
I've been playing Chaos for a while, and I'm going to be sticking with that. Looking at the box, that what actually my favorite minis out of that were the Blood Reavers, and Eric bought the kit, and I pitched to him early on. I was like, hey man, if you need somebody to paint those Blood Reavers, I can. And he was like, nope, pass. You know, I'm gonna take crack at those myself. But now they got the 20 coming out, so I'm just trying to figure out where I'll take the Chaos stuff. But the new things are pretty cool. It's also cool to be rooted in the new storyline. I've been reading through all the fiction as it comes out, and it's cool to be getting something that ties in with the storyline as it exists. So look for some more Chaos coming out of me, the basement of this household.
Now, I'll also say, if you are trying to get your friends into Age of Sigmar, we're hoping that we can put out some episodes that would be easy to kind of send them to. So certainly they can read the rule book. It's 4 pages, not a big deal. Upcoming episodes, we hope to put out, you know, a rules episode where we kind of break that down, a whole episode just about the rules. So it's kind of like, hey, go to the Mortal Realms podcast episode, whatever, and check it out, listen through it. We'll do some breakdowns. We're gonna talk a little bit about the variations, interpretations, the house ruling of it, or the MIR, the most important rule. You know, figure out how you want to play it, what feels the best for you and the person across there, or just ignore the rule and if it seems too difficult, and just, you know, play a different way. So we're going to have episodes like that coming up that we hope you guys enjoy. You know, like I said, hopefully we can come up with some more ideas to help introduce this game to your, you know, group of friends, so that you get more games in. You have more fun playing it. They have fun playing it. And, you know, we spread the hobby, we spread the game, and we make this thing a success.
Right on.
The hobby phase. In the hobby phase, we explore maximizing our experience on the table while minimizing our work at the hobby desk.
The 8 Mortal Realms are a very open place to create and explore from a hobby perspective. The nature of how Age of Sigmar plays also frees us up to model, base, and create our environments with the terrain. We want to stoke the flame of creativity for, you know, the new player, somebody new getting into this hobby, as well as those of you who are experienced and have been doing the hobby for a long time. So the first place I want to go with this conversation is the resources that we all use to get inspired, to see what the breadth of the hobby can be. Mal, where are some places that you go to kind of to resource, or even just Google over, you know, models?
Okay, so I guess if we start at the very highest end, which can be a double-edged sword, and I'll explain what I mean by that. If you go somewhere like Cool Mini or Not, which is a www.coolminiornot.com, they have some really amazingly painted models that just show really the artistry that you can achieve with these awesome models and the great paints that we have available to us just now. And they can really act as a great form of inspiration for people to see what is achievable. But when I say it's a double-edged sword, is that can often be very, very intimidating, especially if you start to, if you see an awesome looking model and you try and paint your first model, and inevitably it will look nothing like that Golden Demon Crystal Brush standard miniature that's on Cool Mini or not. But I think it's important to realize that from the outset, and realize that these people are not only phenomenally talented, but they've been doing it for a very long time, and you will get there. And one of the best places to start yourself off on that journey to the Cool Mini or not standard is, I think is Warhammer TV, which is Games Workshop's YouTube channel, where they have a guy called Duncan Rhodes, who works on the hobby team in Nottingham, and he breaks down, certainly for the Age of Sigmar, the whole box set. I think they've done all the Stormcast stuff so far, and now they're starting to work on the Bloodbound, the Gore-Tide guys, and it just shows you really simple steps how to get some great looking models up and running quickly on the tabletop.
Yeah, I think you've hit on something there with the simple steps. And if that's something that you're just starting off with, when we talk about simple steps, there's a couple places you can go for that. For me, I actually haven't touched on the Warhammer TV a bunch. I've done a little more on forums like the Warhammer Forum or Daka Daka. They always have these painting and modeling threads, and you can find some good resources in there from any skill level, top to bottom. I know, Eric, you can produce models at very, like, you've done some really impressive ogres, really impressive display boards, and you're kind of taking a different tack some with your guys right now.
Yeah, I think that what's interesting is, so I do a lot of looking on Twitter, and I do follow a few of the kind of painting services, which we can touch on a bit. And there's these just beautiful shading and kind of realistic coloring and that sort of thing, or even the, you know, object source lighting, and I throw this stuff out, and it's, you know, it's intimidating to me, even though I know what it is. But what I've been trying to do here is go from the micro to the macro. I want to figure out what's going to make my whole table look great, and all the models on the table at the same time with the terrain look as great as I can get them as quickly and efficiently. I also mentioned that I've been super busy with work, with kids, with, you know, traveling, and I want to get to this cool experience that we're expecting from Age of Sigmar quickly. And so I'm working on the three color wash method, and some of these starter box models have a few more details, but basically I've picked out three colors for each faction, usually a metal, maybe two metals in a color, and I'm blocking them out. And I'm slopping on the wash. I've been away from Agrax Earthshade too long, and I'm loving being back. And there's more that can be done to these, and I may go back to them in the future, you know, over time, and you know, highlight them and do some of those cool effects that I can learn from other things. But I'm you know, buy your models, buy a couple of paints, get a paintbrush, block out the colors, kind of like a paint by the number. And the shade will cover up the mistakes. It's going to be really cool to see them on the table with, you know, differentiating the guys without armor against the guys who do have armor.
I think you can make that even easier if you have a think about the colored aerosol primers that are available. Because I personally have used the new Retributor Gold Spray a lot on my Stormcast Eternals. I think it's great. So it goes, you're immediately going from a three color blocking, color blocking and washing, almost to a two color, because you've already, your base coat is done out the box with the spray. Then, for example, I mean, I'm painting my guys up as Hammers of Sigmar, so I don't really need to worry. But if I was going for that three color standard, I don't really need to worry about maybe some blue and maybe some kind of silvery color for the weapon blades, and then you'd be good to go. And I think it's a really good point that you made, Eric, about being able to go back to the models later on, because if you spend your whole time trying to produce this Golden Demon standard army before it ever sets plastic foot on the table, then you're not gonna have a good time, because you're never gonna get to that core gaming experience, because you're going to be too concerned about the perfectionism of the models. Just accept that what you're going to be doing is a step on the journey towards these amazing looking models. Eventually.
I think what we're all three of us getting at here is if you haven't ever experienced a game where everything on the table is painted, you get rid of that gray plastic, and even if you're not painting the most amazing thing, if everything's on the table is painted, that's a pretty cool experience. I remember the first game I had where everything out there had paint on it, and you were like, wow, this is really cool. It's really fun. It really turns it up to 11. And if you can get that moment, then it's all the more motivating to get you painting further. So,
well, and I'm even happy if I can turn it up to 7, you know, from the gray plastic and bare, you know, table. I think that just adds to it. The other thing I would say, and I've thought about it a few times, I've never pulled the trigger. I'm always want to spend my money on more plastic rather than more paint, but there are services out there that you can, you know, have them order the models that you want, get that kind of base level coloring on them. They can do more amazing stuff if you want to do that, but they can get that on that paint on there for you, and ship them out to you all wrapped up so that you're pulling out of the box, you know, nicely painted, ready to go models for the table. And if that's, you know, a barrier to having the most fun that you can have with this game, then I'd say, you know, go for it. I in particular find a little bit of calm in all of the chaos when I sit down to paint some plastic. So I definitely encourage everybody to, if you've not done it, to try it, to put a little paint on a model and kind of own that too, because I think that adds to the experience of your army when, you know, you're the one who's kind of brought them to life. So.
I find it a really, really good way to relax, unwind. Painting models for me is, it's so absorbing. It you're only worried about one thing, which is making the model look cool. And for the 5, 10, 20 minutes, an hour that you get to spend indulging in your hobby, because it's supposed to be fun at the end of the day, because ultimately you're paying to do it. It's a really good way to switch off and unwind after a tough day. So I can't recommend it enough.
Yeah, and one thing reach back to one of our previous points here, the openness of the game means that when I'm going down to the hobby table right now, I'm painting whatever's exciting to me, whatever's interesting to me. So most recently I was working on a Chaos Spawn, which I had no need for, you know, in a points-based system, but I just had a, you know, I was like, well, that looks fun, I'll do that. And that's been really liberating from a hobby perspective, is like do work on whatever interests me. And that's what it's supposed to be. You know, it's supposed to be your little relaxing time.
The most important thing in all that is that you enjoy the game, right? Hobby can be as big a part of the game as you want it to be. It can be a small part of the game for you. But if you know, getting some cool paint on the table, cool terrain on the table, hopefully we'll be able to shed some light. One of the things I just did, I had a old terrain set. It's called the Magrath Throne, an old kit. I think that was the name of it.
Magrath.
And so it was just a bunch of skulls. But I like them better now. These four parts to build this stone tower. Laid them down on their side and threw some cork around them and spray painted it black, light dry brush and some picking at it. And I've got these kind of mounds, these skull mounds, which fit perfectly in the Age of Sigmar. And you know, it's not going to take me long to knock out, you know, the rest of those and have just more cool terrain to put on the table. Easy. Don't make it so hard on yourself unless you have the time and you really enjoy it and you get something out of it, then make as much time for it as you can. If it's most important for you to get, you know, cool shit on the table, hopefully we can help.
It's when you're talking about the terrain there. I'm looking at the Age of Sigmar hardback book, and there's a picture in here. I want to say it is on page 43. For those of you guys listening at home who have the book, and it's a full color page drawing of something called the Shimmerfall campaign, and it's talking about when Nurgle attacked the Jade Kingdoms in the realm of Garan, so in the realm of life, and some of the wacky terrain that they have going on in this picture. So they ranging from, you know, the huge tree in the movie Avatar that they're all they're all fighting over. Now, if you imagine that flying around the countryside, that's what they call something called the Sky Oak. Now, good luck to you if you want to try and recreate that on the table. But it just speaks to the fact that there's in the, you know, whereas before in other war games or in other editions of this particular war game, we may have been we were in a sandbox, and the sandbox, wherever you stood in the sandbox, you could see the edge because it was one world, and it had a almost like a pseudo historical setting. But now all bets are off. You can create anything that your twisted imagination can come up with, and it's a home. It's like I said right at the very start of the show, there is a home for it in Age of Sigmar, which is amazing.
Yeah, let that wide open aspect fuel your hobby.
For sure.
The campaign phase.
In the campaign phase, we explore the Age of Sigmar experience on the table. Rules, scenarios, new tactics, and narrative campaigns.
So now we're going to kind of get a little wide open and talk about the gameplay itself. Davey, you're the only person I've played with so far, Age of Sigmar. What is the game like for you?
We've got, at first, you look at four pages of rules and you think, well, there's not all that much I can do. It feels somewhere in between a skirmish and a massive battle. Like it's more than just a couple guys. It's less than just huge hordes. But we're finding that within those small limitations of the four pages of rules and whatever battle scrolls you have out, there's actually a fair amount there, and it can move pretty quickly. I don't know what are your experiences in that respect, Ben Mel.
I think it. You know, I've only managed to play a few games thus far. The bulk of my energy has been put into the kind of hobby aspect that we spoke about. But I think that you can. The four pages of core rules really belie the complexity that you can have in this game. So those four rule pages, they're absolutely enough to get you up and running. And I think the consolidation of all the important information into the war scrolls, you know, just there's you don't have to worry about rolling dice against a matrix. It's literally all there for you. It's like, right, I need to roll this to hit, roll this to hit, roll this to save. Happy days, really, really good. But there are so many synergies and complexities built into the war scrolls in terms of what in another game system might be called a universal special rule. You don't really have that so much in Age of Sigmar. You have loads and loads of individual special rules for each unit, which I think is really cool because it means it allows them to show their individuality. And when you get them playing off against other units in the same faction, for example, because it's very obvious to see where some units have been designed to support others, that's really interesting. But then when you throw that on top of that, the next level of complexity or interestingness, which is what you can get from battalions, you know, taking specific formations, even more synergy there. And then you throw that into a battle plan, a specific scenario, then you've gone from you know, what could look fairly simplistic to something which is seriously nuanced and complex. So I think that's one of the great things about this game is that it's easy to learn, but almost impossible to master. And ultimately, that's what we're looking for.
What I really like about the games we've played so far are how the heroes play such a central role in how the game is played or how the battle is won. And they provide kind of the center of a wheel of synergies. The hero has hero attributes that they get to dish out, dole out, kind of like a general would commands or inspiration, you know, and say, you know, give them order and direction. And so by placing that ability on a particular unit, you know, you're giving them kind of something to do and go do. You're charging with them with something, but then you've got, you know, you've got wizards, you've got priests, you've got the stoker, which I don't know, some different kind of like engineer type thing, and then you've got other units that with them around, they add other kinds of boosts to each other. But so there's different units that do certain things, and both you need to get them in there to be able to use it. And some of them are decent fighters, but they're gonna, you got to protect them. You know, what's important in the army, you know, is the general. So they should be protected. They might be, you know, fighty and be able to put out a lot of damage, but they can roll bad sometimes. And, you know, you put enough attacks on them, you know, they're going to go down and your synergies are busted, you know? So that's the other thing too, is like, you can have multiple heroes on the table. So you can have, you know, different contingencies and groups, and kind of this group over here works together and this group over here works together. So you got these teams almost. And so it's, I don't know, there's just some really cool things that, I think from that the hero at the center, that make this a really interesting game on the table.
I think we'll get into it in more in future episodes, but an interesting talking about the heroes in specific, because they do things in the hero phase, which is at the very beginning of your turn before anything else that you've done, you're really planning, because they're so pivotal to your army, but they take their actions before anyone is able to move to advantage that. Basically, you need to be planning far enough in advance to set that up, and that's where I think a lot of the depth of the game is starting to present itself to me, at least, is trying to plan to stack those synergies in the right place, because I need to anticipate where I'm going to need them, because I won't be able to adapt it on the turn itself. That's been kind of a fun thing to work around. I don't know if you encountered any of that, Mel.
I'll be honest with you, no, because I've played so far, we've not been using the starter set. We've been using some existing armies, and we've tended to use troops, use sort of big blocks of troops without too much in the way of special characters, or what might be called special characters. Before, we used some big blocks of lizard men. So now Seraphon, you know, Saurus warriors, and some temple guard and the skinks, and we were using them against some high elf phoenix guard and some archers. So we were playing, kind of deliberately playing the sort of the troop choices against the troop choices, without too much in the way of, you know, of extra special characters. Because I'll be honest with you, this was the first game that we played. It was the same day that the war scrolls and the rules got released, and we only managed to get everything sorted out at about 11:30 at night. And we'd all had a couple of adult beverages, so we wanted to make it as streamlined as possible. So GW did a great job of making that easy for us.
So as we've been playing, there's certainly been some, you know, the pitch battle. You know, we played a game of that, and some of the core rules gave us some ways to make it less of just a pitch battle. It gave us an objective. The sudden death scenario kind of gave us an objective, but then we also played through one of the it was a breakthrough scenario in the first narrative book that came out, and the game really changed. And you know, I was playing an ogre army, which is, you know, meant to be, you know, they're gonna be amazing at combat because they're freaking ogres, and you're playing a Slaanesh fast cav army, and you had to get your army past my ogres, and it completely changed where the balance of capabilities were in that scenario. You needed an army that dished out a lot of damage in order to stop an army that could charge in and then flee and across the table so fast. We almost had the exact right armies to try and, you know, make that scenario happen. But if we had just done a pitch battle, you know, meet in the center and, you know, see who wins, it wouldn't have been a contest. It wouldn't have been fun. But because of the scenario, it changed what was valuable in an army.
Yeah, the other piece of that is that the nature of the scenario was such that we're both trying to do different things than we might have normally tried to do. Like we were trying to, I was trying to block his, Eric's, heroes who got positioned on the far side of the board, is trying to block them from joining the fray. Similarly, Eric's trying to block me from moving down the field. So we're taking these blocking actions, which we might not have attempted. And so those are aspects of the game that we're going to be able to put into play when we play other scenarios. But we might not have put much thought into those without that scenario. And the other thing, when we talk about scenarios, there's a lot of them. You know, there's going to be a lot of different ways to play this game. You can probably go quite a number of games without playing the same scenario twice. That's pretty interesting to me.
So how is the, have you guys tried to play through the sort of the or the camp, the sort of the mini campaign that's in the comes with the starter set, or have you just gone? I mean, did you try to do it in a linked fashion? Because I know it suggests, you know, it's obviously designed to have the, you know, the first game being Hammerhand versus the Korgorath. But have you sort of tried to proxy that that kind of idea with the ogres versus the Slaanesh, and take it all the way through and see how it works out? Or have you just been kind of picking individual missions from that campaign or mini campaign?
So we played the box set with the models that came with the box
awesome.
Set. And it kind of plays like, you know, the beginning of you know, a video game, where it tries to give you scenarios that highlight the skills of each of the units. So, for instance, the very first one that Davey had mentioned has the Korgorath and the Stoker versus the Vandis Hammerhand on a Drakoth. You know, these are just big models that are meant to charge in and do blows and show, well, maybe not always meant to charge in, but, you know, just the kind of where that matchup was, that this is the size and scope of these two units. But then you had, I think, one of a really fun kind of thinking scenario was the prosecutors versus the bloodletters, blood reavers. So you've got, you know, flying units versus a massive bodies on the ground. And how do you, you know, it was a narrow space. It was a 2x4. And so I had to get the length, the prosecutors had to get the length of the table, but had to get past or sometimes how get through. And I remember, you know, that I, you know, first thing I tried was to just plow in so that I, you know, would definitely only get one group, you know, in on me at a time. And I demolished them that first time. And then I don't remember if you got the charge off on the next one or if I charged in again, but the tables turned. So, you know, the right dice, and I was down to one prosecutor, and I had, you know, I don't know, another 14 inches to go to try and get off the table, and whether or not I was going to get that turn to do it, you know, that turn back and forth mattered, you know, for me to win that, which, so it could have swung either way. It was, you know, on the edge the whole time, even though it was a small game, three models on my side versus 20 on his, unbalanced or whatever. All of the pieces fit together to make for a really interesting, thoughtful game that we, you know, and then from there on, I mean, we did do the pitch battle, but like I said, like, I don't think we're going to not play a scenario. I don't think that moving forward, we're going to choose to just line up stuff and go at each other. I think story has to be a part of it. And I don't know why you wouldn't put it as a part of it, given how much fun that was.
For sure. And how, to what extent have you found that the kind of the battle shock rules have had a big impact on the game as you've been playing it? Because when I read the sort of the core rule book or the core rule pamphlet, I'm always struck by how brutal that could be. It, you know, if it starts going wrong from a battle shock perspective, then it can go wrong and keep going wrong. I mean, maybe it might be worth you guys kind of speaking about exactly what Battleshock is before you get into that.
Battleshock itself, it's basically representing the courage of those troops on the field. So higher it is, the more likely they're going to stay even in the face of adversity. The lower it is, the more likely they're going to run when the going gets bad. Interestingly, it's not removing the whole units, just increasing the number of casualties represent those folks running away. As far as how we saw it in our games, it was pretty pivotal. In the prosecutor versus blood reavers battle, that was what wiped the unit the reavers out. Was they got the first group got hit, and I was like, cool, they're gonna hang on here while their buddies come in and pile on the top, and like, oops, no, battle shock, they're all gone. Now I've got a problem, and was trying to bounce back. Similarly, we played the one where it was just Ionis Cryptborn, the Relictor.
I'm super excited to find out what his deal is before.
That's exciting. Yeah, what the background is. But he's standing there with three Retributors, and crucially, like, all it took was one battle shock test that went bad for them. I managed to kill one, and then they managed to lose another one for battle shock. And one of those models, that was enormous. I mean, it was a big swing. So I think it's a nice way of doing it. I think there's some it's a big impact on the game, but in a good way.
The other thing I'd say is what makes the play on the table different than what you'd see in the rule book is that if you're fighting out in the open, things die fast, right? If you're just in the middle of the battlefield, throwing your raw stats, you know, my 4+ and 3+ versus your, 3+ save or 4+ save, things die fast. The thing that changes that, and it's not, it can't, is important because you've got to choose which ones you're going to try and give these bonuses. So one from the heroes, what are you going to buff, right? What are you going to give, either more protection to or more strength to? But then also terrain. There's almost no reason, if you can help it, to ever not fight in terrain. Like, get into the terrain. And, the first one to the terrain, if you can be the one charged, you're at an advantage. And so I'm, when I'm talking about, like, I want to get as much terrain on the table to look cool and to give space to kind of have these effects. And, you don't necessarily have to use all of the terrain effects that are possible. The game we played, we kind of looked at the terrain and said, well, what should that be, right? Should that be sinister? Should that be deadly? That sort of thing. And kind of just picked and choose what felt good thematically in the new, So there's just that battle shock makes more of a difference when you're out in the open taking a lot of damage. If you can mitigate that through a spell or through an inspiring presence or whatnot, great. I think some of the armies where it, like, you take away battle shock. That's where some of the fun of the game is in, am I going to take enough or lose just enough to make that a risky check or what? So, but it's definitely a pivotal. It can ruin some units' day. So, we're going to be going through a lot more on the table stuff, but hopefully this just gives you an idea of what Age of Sigmar is like on the table. We'll get into specific games in this section. We'll talk through some of the campaigns that we're playing. Mal with your group, and Davey and I with some of our group. Dig into some of these rules specifically and say, try and find examples of how they come into effect in really interesting ways. And again, ways that help make the game more fun, and maybe alternate ways to play, Battle Shock or something like that, so that you can try in your gameplay. At the end of the day, it's on the table that is often the most important. Whether that's the models on the table and how it looks, whether or not who's at the other side of the table, playing the game and kind of how you've decided to make the game for the two of you or the three of you, the story that you get to tell about the table, right, to people later in the kind of the history that you build up in your own groups, so... I'm really excited to play some more Age of Sigmar on the table.
Yeah, me too. Can't wait.
And hopefully you guys will be there with us. We'd be interested in hearing your feedback as you've made your way through this first episode of the Mortal Realms. We're going to have some contact information for you in a second. Some things that you can look forward to will be, like we talked about, delving into the rules. We're going to be getting into the fluff. When I say fluff, I mean the background. We've all been pretty enthusiastic about reading some of that background and seeing where this goes. It's one of the cool things, it being new. We'll be coming back at you soon here, but thanks for sticking with us here in the Mortal Realms.
Check you later.
Well, our time has expired, and it's time for our reforging. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Mortal Realms podcast. If you know someone who's curious about Age of Sigmar, tell them about this podcast. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, Mal is at Mortal Realms, Davey is at Red_Zeke, and Eric is at Stone Monk Gamer. For Sigmar!
For Sigmar!
Blood for the Blood God.
You're going to obviously, Davey, suggest chaos because you're evil.